I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
The Drive Nation podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel.
We've got a lot to get through in this episode of the podcast. Last week, we promised that we'd come back to the technically speaking stuff that we did a little while ago. A few of you were good enough to write in and say that you enjoyed that last technically speaking episode. I think probably most people enjoyed listening to two idiots try to understand quite complex things, but we'll give it another go. We're going to be talking about different suspension arrangements. But, Andrew, before we get stuck into that, there's a car that we have to cover off in some detail. You've been driving it. It's one of, for me certainly, one of the most intriguing and exciting performance cars in a very, very long time. So can you get us started, please, on the Toyota GR Yaris?
Yeah, what an interesting car. It's the kind of car, I guess, that I thought people wouldn't make anymore, because it's so left field. And I always thought, and, you know, we've talked about this before, and you've written about it before on DN, that, you know, the days of the true maverick car have gone, because they cost so much to develop and you never sell enough of them. And the truth is, with the GR Yaris, I mean, as we both know, that car was conceived for a completely different reason. It was genuinely going to be a homologation special. I mean, Toyota wanted to do their 2021 Yaris rally car in a radically different way. So they had to homologate a whole new car. And then halfway through this year, they went, nah, not going to do that. But they had this car. I'm right in saying, Dan, that they canned it because the rally car, that is, the 2021 WRC car, because of COVID and money, and because of the new race coming in 2022, it just wasn't worth going down that road. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. Fundamentally, the car was conceived as a homologation special because they wanted to homologate that three-door shell, the much lower roof line, 95 mil lower than a normal Yaris. Lots of other things as well, I'm sure.
Yeah. So, you know, like the best homologation specials, even though there was no car for it ultimately to homologate, it's just full of trick stuff. It's like, sort of goes back to, I guess, to the sort of, you know, the old E30 M3s and that sort of thing, which look superficially like other E30 3 Series BMWs, but were in fact completely different. I mean, this, from a distance, looks kind of Yaris-ish, but it's, I mean, somebody wrote what it's got in common with normal Yaris you can buy in a showroom, and it's things like, you know, the front headlights and the windscreen wipers, and like nothing else. There isn't a single body panel that it has in common. The platform is different too. I mean, it's on a kind of hybrid platform, which has got nothing to do with electric drive systems, but the front end of the car and the back end of the car are actually developed from different cars. So the front end, I think, is a mainly Yaris derived platform, and the back owes more to the Corolla and the CHR. So it is, and I use this word advisedly, unique thing. It's not like anything else that's out there. And really, it's only Yaris in its badge and kind of the way that it looks. Because, you know, the moment, you know, even before you get below the surface, I mean, it's got things like, you know, a carbon roof and an alley bonnet and doors and rear tailgate. And then you delve down within it. And it's got this unique three-cylinder, 1.6-litre, whatever it is, 257 horsepower engine, the most powerful three-cylinder engine in the world, and its own in-house developed four-wheel drive system. If you get the circuit pack, you get, you know, not just the usual sort of, you know, stiffened springs, dampers and roll bars, but you get front and rear torsion differentials too. I mean, this car is as trick as you like. And we all sort of saw this, didn't we, when the car was announced and the spec came out, and just thought, and we were all just thinking just one thing, please let it be as good to drive as it appears to be on paper. And it is, and I just couldn't be happier about it. And I know a few people who've got orders in, and I'm just as jealous as hell, because it's just a fabulous car, and it's fabulous for reasons. Okay, of course it's ridiculously quick and it's got huge amounts of grip and everything else, but actually what I like about it, because I'm a 55-year-old bloke, is that it's actually perfectly usable. What they haven't done is turned it into a racetrack refugee, something which, you know, is unbelievably stiff and unyielding and fairly horrible to drive unless you're driving it as fast as you can possibly drive it. It's a perfectly nice, normal, natural car to go about your day-to-day business in. And then you get on a decent road and it's just off. And that engine is so eager. It's got a 6-speed manual gearbox. I mean, who'd have thought that we'd be celebrating that? But it does, and it's fantastic. It's actually a really tough car to pick holes in. I mean, you can. I have a particular problem that, you know, if you go and drive it around a racetrack, which I have, in fact, a very wet, very bumpy Castle Coombe, it's just not quite as playful as I'd like it to be. I think it's so caught up in the business of being really fast and really impressive. It's just forgotten a little bit of fun insofar as, I mean, you can probably remember the way that Evo Mitsubishis, you could back them into a corner on a trailing throttle and you'd be as sideways as you'd like. And you knew that all you had to do to get out of it was hit the accelerator as hard as you can and the four-wheel drive would just snap it straight and you could just be a complete idiot. And that was, you know, a large chunk of why we love those cars, because they were so agile and balletic in the way they did things, and I would prefer a little bit more of that from the Yaris. But hey, you know, I'm not here to carp about it. It's just a wonderful thing. And if anybody thinks that £33,000 is a lot of money to spend on a Yaris, all I can say is go and drive one, and you won't think that anymore.
Yeah, so I've not driven one. I drive one next week, this week as the podcast goes out, and I'm just can't wait. So that's really interesting. You want just a bit more playfulness from it on circuit. So presumably you toyed about with the different drive modes, which is effectively just to control the four-wheel drive system. And just to run through it, normal mode is a 40-60 front-to-rear torque split, and then you've got sport mode, which is 30-70 front to rear, so really heavily rear biased, and then is it track or whatever it's called, is 50-50.
I think it's called race, isn't race. It? 50-50.
Okay. So that's for ultimate performance, isn't it?
Yeah. So forget that. You just want to put it in sport.
Yeah.
And it does do more in sport, but still for me not quite enough.
Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it is really good. And, you know, and I'm slightly mindful of the fact that, you know, we are lucky enough, aren't we, to drive these cars in conditions and on tracks that, you know, to be honest, most owners won't do a lot of the time. I also, when I drove it at Castle Coombe, it happened to be extremely wet. And I thought if it was ever going to go and do the big sort of yeehaw sideways thing, it would do it in those conditions. But it didn't. And I was there, I was there with Autocar and we had all their testers there and we all absolutely loved it. But, you know, we all did think the same thing about it. But still a great, great car, you know, and actually, you know, because I'm so old, I've driven all those, you know, old ones, not just Subarus and, you know, Mitsubishis, but, you know, going back to Escort Cosworths and Integrales and Sunny GTIRs and that sort of thing. And, you know, this in 2020 is as good as any of those ever were. You know, people always go on about the Integrale, and I think I said before that I've always thought it a slightly overrated car. For my money, this is this is a much better car than an Integrale. I mean, a better car today than the Integrale was then. And put the two side by side and give me a decent road or a racetrack, and I would just go straight and get in the door of the Toyota. It really is that good. So what we're not doing is going, okay, well, this car is cool given the limitations of 2020, and we know how much less fun that we think we have these days than in the past. By any standards at all, it's absolutely cracking.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. So talk to us about how the car feels on the road. I'm thinking proper bumpy British B road undulations, lumps and bumps all over the place. Is it not super stiff?
It's not super stiff, and you know, and I don't think this is a sort of car that spent, you know, all its development life, you know, pounding around the Nürburgring. I think this was a car which was probably set up on a rally stage, you know, and you have to build compliance into it. And you know, I drove it. I've driven it on lots of roads. I've driven it mainly across Exmoor on some very, very challenging roads. Again, in you know, a range of different conditions, and it is. It does that lovely thing. It kind of breathes with the road, and it makes you feel slightly worried. It does make you feel in the way that homologation specials have in the past. It does make you feel a bit superhuman, and because it's got those brilliantly compact dimensions, and because it's got so much traction, it basically has unlimited traction. Because, you know, 257 horsepower and a similar amount of torque, 266 pound-feet, I think, from memory. Maybe wrong there. You know, we're not talking huge numbers, but because it's quite light, I mean, it weighs less than 1,300 kilos, which in 2020 is quite light. And because it doesn't have an awful lot to transmit, it's got so much traction. And because it's so compact and the way the four-wheel drive system works is so clever, and if you get the circuit pack, you also get those brilliant Michelin Pilot 4S tyres. It just feels, you know, you could embarrass cars costing 10 times as much on a decent British B road, in that, because the dimensions really make a difference. You really don't have to slow down for very much. And while they may be struggling around, you know, scrabbling, trying to find a bit of traction, a bit of grit here, you're just gone. You know, you can use. I mean, it's all about. I mean, if you drove a P1 or a LaFerrari or something like that. I mean, you know, and we've talked about this before. You only kind of get to use 30-40% of what it can do on a public road. But with the Yaris, you're using, you know, 85-90% of what it can do, without being, you know, completely antisocial, and you're having a ball doing it. So, you know, it's, yeah, not much not to like there.
A few people read the review on DN. You gave it a 9 out of 10. I think some were expecting a 10. So why not the full 10 out of 10 from you?
Two reasons, really, I guess. One is the game changer rule. I don't think it is a game changer. Probably the closest thing to a game changer we've had since the A110 came out. But I think we've seen enough cars do that sort of thing well enough for it not quite to justify that. I also, at the same time, I drove a Civic Type R, the new very light one. And I actually thought the Civic was even more engaging, had better feel and that sort of thing. But really the reason is just this, the fact I knocked one off just because it's not quite as fun at the precise moment when you'd expect it to be its most fun. And to me, it wasn't actually a difficult decision. I wasn't agonizing over it at all. To me, it was a very clear, obvious 9. It's not one of those things. It's not like it was a 9.5 if we did that. To me, and for us,
yeah, that's good, isn't it? It's really good.
Nine is really, we don't give out many 9s. And you know, you've got to be good. I mean, 9 is best in its class. I put it and the Civic absolutely side by side.
Okay, so a couple of things I want to ask you. The cabin and the seating position, talk me through those briefly.
Cabin is, you know, I don't know what people expect. It's not what that car's about, is it? The seating position is a bit perched, it is a bit high. It didn't particularly trouble me. I think it did trouble some other people, and it's strange because I usually like sitting, well, I always like sitting very low in cars. I like feeling that I'm in a car rather than on it. But maybe because it was entertaining me so much in so many other ways, maybe I didn't dwell on that too much. And the cabinet itself, it's got, you know, it's got everything you need. Yeah, I think it's even got cruise control, and it's got, you know, climate control and, yeah, nav and everything else. And none of it's particularly attractive, but it all works well enough. And in a car like that, you know, you just need, it's like, you know, your A110, which we'll talk about later on. It's got enough of what you need in there. It doesn't have to be all bells and all whistles and all look absolutely gorgeous. It's just got to be there, and it is.
Mm. Okay, and finally, how ridiculous does it make the Mini GP3 look?
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. I haven't thought about that until now. I mean... I mean, they cannot be compared. You know, unless somebody came to you and showed me and said to me, show me precisely the right and the wrong way of doing that kind of car. And then you could have them in the same sentence. Otherwise, no, nah, sorry, there's absolutely, yeah, one is a poser's paradise and the other is a proper driving machine. And that's as much as you need to know.
I suppose the thing that really resonates with me about the GI Yaris is Toyota's approach with it and the lengths it went to in its execution. It's on a pretty much a bespoke platform. It's got its own shell. It's just unheard of, really. And what I find interesting about that is that you compare the approach Toyota took with this car to the approach it took with the new Supra, which was developed in partnership with BMW. We might feel slightly differently about this, but certainly we must agree that Toyota came in for a huge amount of criticism for what some people felt was a half-hearted approach with the Supra.
I think what I found difficult about the Supra, you know, I don't blame it for the fact that if you tested it against its closest rivals, which would be a Cayman and an A110, it would come third, which it would, I have no doubt, because the Cayman and the A110 are two of the most formidable cars that any other car could expect to come up against. What I find difficult with the Supra is, when I went to drive it to launch, you know, the engineers told me, and I'm sure they were sincere, that, you know, okay, fine, you know, it does share basic same underpinnings with a BMW Z4, but that the two engineering teams had nothing whatever to do with each other. They literally didn't know what the others were up to. And yet, but if you're going to go that way and you know that BMW is going to go down a sort of touring GT route, why didn't they make the Supra more sporting than it is? And I hope it's because there is a sort of GR Supra coming. That's my problem with it, is that given the opportunity to, you know, although, you know, we all know cars can use, you know, the same underpinnings to dramatically different ends, why they didn't do something different with it and make it a proper sports car. It feels, and always did feel to me, like a pulled punch, which is the last thing in the world I'd say about the Yaris.
Okay, that's great. Fine, well, that's the GR Yaris, and I'm just gagging to have a go in one now.
Can we come back next week and I will shut up and you can, you know, we'll just do 5 minutes on it and you can tell me what you think, unless you concur with me, because you are, you know, massively into your rally cars and this is actually much more your kind of car than mine, and I think it would be good to get your views on it too.
So actually, one last comment before we move on. Somebody left a comment on Drive Nation saying, for the money, would you rather have an Alpine A110 and a GR Yaris? So that would come to about 80k, a bit more maybe. Or would you have a Boggo 911, a Carrera? Which I thought was a really interesting question. And I put it to our followers and in our stories on Instagram. And 2,700 people responded. And the outcome was that 59% of people would have the GR Yaris and the A110.
Well, I mean, that's fantastic, isn't it? And I completely understand it. I mean, to me, I'm going to be really boring about this. I'm going to say you're not comparing apples with apples. I mean, a 911 is a wonderful everyday car, and a GR Yaris and the A110 are both, you know, the amount of overlap between a GR Yaris and an A110 is considerable. So whereas a 992 is doing something, to me, distinctly different. Gun to head, yeah, I'd have the Yaris and the A110, but I don't think anybody's sitting there wondering whether to buy a 992 or a Yaris and the A110. That's such a boring answer, isn't it? I'm so sorry.
I think if nothing else, it demonstrates that Deanna's are, you know, as into the subject matter as anyone, aren't they? And they're not starry-eyed about a flashy 911 necessarily.
No, absolutely not. No, because the thing about Deanna's is quite often, I mean, a lot of them, you know, are faced with these decisions. They do spend their own money on these sorts of cars, and they know their stuff.
Great. Okay, well, let's move on. We're going to talk about different suspension arrangements. And like we did with the last Technically Speaking episode, you'll all be well aware that Andrew and me are not engineers. So we're not trying to describe from an engineering point of view how these different suspension arrangement works, but more what the advantages are, what the drawbacks are, and crucially, what you feel from behind the wheel. The sort of default, sort of baseline suspension arrangement is a McPherson strut.
Yeah, certainly at the front.
So it's effectively a lower arm. It might be a wishbone or it might be two separate links, and they'll meet the wheel carrier, the hub, basically at the wheel, and they'll meet the spring and damper, which is the strut, and that goes straight up into the wheel arch. So it's kind of triangulated, isn't it? And it's very simple, it's very strong, it's easy to package. It's actually very good in a crash because there are fewer components, essentially. And all that stuff's great. But the big drawback is that when you turn into a corner, the car goes round the bend and the body leans. Because of the way, I am going to use the word kinematics here, but I'm not going to dig into it any deeper than that. Because of the way the kinematics work with that type of suspension arrangement, effectively, the outside wheel, let's say it's the front tyre, the front wheel, the outside tyre will lean over into positive camber. And the tyre is therefore not in square contact with the road, so it can no longer produce the strong and consistent grip that it would otherwise be able to. It was this type, the McPherson strut, it refers to Earl S. McPherson, who invented it as a Chevrolet car engineer back in the, I think, 50s, perhaps before then, actually. But so, as you've said, Andrew, it is the sort of go-to suspension arrangement, particularly on the front axle.
You have missed off its most important attribute.
Go on.
It's cheap.
I think I said cheap. I'm going to back myself on that. I meant to. It's in my notes.
Okay. I might have been, having a sip of tea at the time. Let's not be shy about this. That's why car manufacturers. Okay. Cheap and easy to package. I mean, whatever else they'll say, and you'll have manufacturers going on about the wonders of the McPherson strut. The reason they use it is it's cheap and easy to package. And packaging is so important these days. And as is cost of manufacture. And frankly, for most people, most of the time in most cars, the fact that it may be kinematically less than entirely optimal is of no consequence whatever to them. And, you know, it's a really, really good all-purpose system, isn't it? Which is why so many cars use them. So I think it just makes sense. The only time I get annoyed with this, it's like when people talk about, you know, torsion beam rear axles, which I'm sure we'll come on to. I only get annoyed when people start to say, oh yes, you know, these things are actually, they're fantastic. We can get exactly the right dynamic response out of this that we want. And you just know it's cobblers, that you know that it's there because it's cheap and easy to package. End of.
Yeah. And the thing is, for most applications, a McPherson strut is absolutely fine, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So the big drawback, as I said, was that camber change that you get when cornering. And the way that you prevent that happening is you fit not a McPherson strut, but double wishbones or a multi-link setup. Because the big advantage of that is that you keep control of the camber change, or that there's very little camber change as the body leans in a corner. And that means that the tyre is always pressed squarely into the road where it can generate its strongest and most consistent grip. These more sophisticated arrangements also allow engineers to tune in a better ride, because they can, particularly with a multi-link setup, they can better decouple ride from handling.
Exactly correct. It's all about, particularly at the rear, it's all about locating the wheels and controlling the way that they move, because tyres and wheels don't just move up and down, they move fore and aft as well. And the more points you have, the more points of control you have, the frankly, the more finely you can tune your suspension. So that's why they do it. As you say, it is a way of getting an axle to behave itself in terms of rigidity and in terms of location, but at the same time, not completely torpedoing the ride quality too.
Mm. The drawbacks are cost, complexity, packaging. they take a lot more tuning work as well.
Yeah, and weight. Yeah, that's another potential. I mean, depending what system you're comparing it to. And as we know, the unsprung mass is the least ideal form of mass, but the advantages are considerable. And this is why, you know, and we find this particularly in the sort of family hatchback sector. That's why, you know, you have to be really careful if you go and buy a Ford Focus or a Volkswagen Golf or a Mercedes A-Class and probably some others as well. These days, you know, there was a time when all those cars would have just have had, you know, proper multi-link rear axles. But they don't anymore. Some of them have got multi-link rear axles and some of them just have very simple, cheap torsion beam rear axles. And these manufacturers are very often not too keen about coming forward and saying which ones have which system. And you may be listening to this thinking, well, you know, how can it possibly matter? In fact, knowing you lot, you probably know exactly why it matters. But all I could say is just go and drive it if you can, or if you ever have a Golf with a proper multi-link rear end, which basically means, you know, any Mark 5 or 6, I think, Golf and some of the Mark 7s, and then just go and drive one with a torsion beam, which would be cheap 7s and 8s. And the difference is night and day, and it's the same with the Mercedes A-Class, and it's the same with the Ford Focus. The difference between having, you know, and you can feel it in really strange bits, like, you know, you can feel it in steering response. You know, you wouldn't have thought that necessarily that, you know, the configuration of the rear axle is going to affect the way the car steers. It does, absolutely. And actually, I mean, this is a case in point. We needed about 3 years ago a new sort of family hack. And you know, as ever, we thought about everything and ended up thinking, right, well, we need a Golf. And I got literally the cheapest Golf you could buy, which is a 1.5 SE NAV, which had a multi-link rear end. And that to me was I would not have bought a Golf with a beam axle at the back. And if you go and drive this Golf that we've got here now with this multi-link rear, I mean, the ride for a little hatchback, I mean, it's just... And it's not just that it's really comfortable, it's really quiet too. It feels very, very sophisticated. You know, it feels Mercedes-Benz like in the way that it rides. And it's a 3-year-old Volkswagen Golf. So yeah, it really, really, really makes a difference.
And you think that difference could be appreciated by
anyone.
Yeah, exactly. We're not talking the most enthusiastic drivers, are we? We're talking most people.
So I've got my sister-in-law who has no interest in cars whatever. She was at the time a district nurse, and so she was driving around all over the place. And she had a Ford Focus, which they gave her to drive around in, and she absolutely loved it. And then one day they said, well, that's done as many miles as you can do in it, so here's your next car. And it was an Astra. And she didn't like that as much. And it wasn't that, you know, one was, you know, had a better equipment level or other. And I can remember talking to her, and she just said, I just don't like the way that it drives as much. And I spoke to her about this, that, the other, and it wasn't the engine or, you know, or the gearbox or anything else. And really what she was describing was the difference between a multi-link and a torsion beam rear axle, although she had absolutely no idea that was it. It does make a difference. And, you know, anybody with literally no interest in cars, if you put them in two Golfs or two A-classes or two Focuses, one with a beam and one with a multi-link, they would be able to detect it at once. I have no doubt about that.
Yeah, it's that old Mark 1 Focus syndrome, isn't it? It's most buyers had no clue why they liked the car, but they would describe it, they would say something like, it's smooth to drive, or I just feel more confident in it, or something. And it's because it had that sophisticated rear end on it.
That absolutely game-changing rear end on it. And, you know, and look at things like the Civic, you know, the Civic, which had, you know, used to have, you know, the Civic hatchback used to have, you know, unequal length wishbones at all four corners, which was crazy. And then in the, what was it, the previous but one generation, they just thought they could stick a torsion beam rear end on it and get away with it. And the only way that they could get the Type R to handle at all was to basically give it no ride quality whatsoever. And we all started jumping up and down, and surprise, surprise, they stuck a multi-link rear end back on it again. And, you know, now it's the best kind of car of its kind in the class. And this is not a coincidence.
So why is the beam, a beam rear axle, such a disadvantage?
Well, because it's basically, it's a non-independent system. You know, the great thing about independent suspension is that, you know, on any given axle, you know, one wheel is not affected by what the other one does. And on a beam axle, which is literally, it's a beam that twists across the axle, you know, of course, one wheel is directly and dramatically affected by the actions of the other. So you cannot isolate each impact event. And so you get a deterioration in ride quality, or at least that's the way that my totally uneducated engineering brain has always looked at it. But, you know, to put it in most simple terms, you know, cars with beam axles, regardless of what they tell you, just don't ride as well as cars with proper multi-link rear suspension. And also, because they're so simple, you've got very limited tuning opportunities. Vauxhall actually did a clever thing. They stuck a thing called the Watts linkage in there, which helped them separate out the loads and between ride and handling, and they and that's why Astra's got an awful lot better. But it's still not the same. It's still not the same. And cars that there aren't many cars in that class, you know, particularly in the sort of hatchback class, that persist with torsion beam rear axles, because they tend to be the more expensive end of the range. You know, Focus, you know, whether it's a Focus ST or a Golf GTI. Or an A250A class, well, I mean, they all obviously have the multi-link rear end. I think the exception, though, is the Megane. I think that still has a beam at the back, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think it does. I think it does. They've tended to persist with the beam, haven't they, at Renault Sport?
Yeah, and they have. And to be fair, you know, they've always got them to handle. And I think that if anybody has done the beam better than anybody else, I would say it's definitely Renault. But, you know, there is obviously a price to be paid in ride quality. You can't have both with a beam.
So those are the most commonly used suspension arrangements these days and for the last few decades, really. But Andrew, are there any sort of weird systems from many, many years ago that you want to quickly run us through?
Well, the systems that they used years and years and years ago were very primitive. They just had axles supported by leaf springs, and leaf springs were the same that they used on, you know, wagons in the 19th century.
And Corvettes.
And they were very, very... Sorry?
And Corvettes,
yes. Oh, God, they still use them. Do they still use a transverse link? A transverse leaf?
I'm not sure about the mid-engine one, but certainly beforehand, with the last...
Yeah, they had transverse... And to be fair, they actually worked really well,
yeah,
didn't they?
Yeah.
But, now, the interesting one was the De Dion tube, which is actually still used by Caterhams to this day, apart from which Caterham doesn't use a De Dion tube. In fact, there are two.
Oh, you're going to have to tell me.
Okay, so there was the ones which had the Suzuki, but they've stopped making them now, haven't they? So the 160, but also the CSR. The Caterham CSR had a fully independent, in fact, still does, because they still make them, fully independent rear end. But I divert. So the De Dion tube was a way of... not having to carry the enormous mass of your rear axle. So you would have a fixed diff and drive shafts coming out of it, and then the suspension loads were taken by this De Dion tube that ran across the back of the car. And it actually made a big difference. It started becoming, I think De Dion was a bloke who was around, in fact, he made his own cars, De Dion's, in the early 20th century, but they became increasingly popular, increasingly used in racing in the 1950s. And then companies like, I'm trying to think, so cars like Alphas in the 70s and 80s used them a lot. And I don't know anybody else uses them these days other than Caterham. But it was kind of like a halfway house between a proper live axle, which would, you know, which you'd probably have leaf springs or whatever, and a properly independent system. So, yeah, it's not as good as one, but not as bad as the other, if you like. So that's, I guess, the one that I would choose to talk about most.
Very good. Okay. Right, well, I want to start talking about the Alpine A110 a little bit. The car generally...
Oh, why is that then?
we'll talk about the car generally and then a little bit about my own car, just because I've had it now for a year, just over a year, actually. And I think it might be quite interesting to have a quick natter about that. But before we move on to my car specifically, I want to keep it in the area of suspension arrangements and talk about the double wishbones on the Alpine and why they're so fundamental to the way that car drives. Actually, I think they're as fundamental to the way that Alpine drives as its aluminium body and platform. You know, it's lightweight dimension, it's lightweight build, and it's very compact dimensions. And to give it some context, the Cayman has got McPherson struts up front. So it's in that way the Alpine is a more sophisticated car. And the point about it is that fundamentally, because the A110 has got double wishbone suspension and very supple springs as well, the grip is in the A110's chassis. The grip is not in the tyres. And so you compare that to other cars that have less sophisticated suspension, but very wide and very sticky tyres. All their grip is, it's sort of dumb mechanical grip from a big fat tyre. But if you can, if you can give a car...
Because that's what you have to do, isn't it? You have to, you know, that's the way, if you have a compromised chassis, either through its suspension or through the rigidity of the actual platform, the only way you can provide grip, unless you're going to do it aerodynamically, is by piling more and more rubber onto the road.
Yeah, exactly. So what Alpine's engineers have done with the A110, by giving that very supple suspension, making it very light, and keeping control of the camber change in cornering because of the double wishbones, what they're doing is getting a tremendous amount of grip out of a relatively narrow tyre, and tyres that do not have an aggressive tread pattern or compound, okay? And that means that, well, A, the wheels and tyres are lighter, so it's that virtuous cycle again, isn't it, of keeping weight down. And also, the tyres, they're not compromised in the wet. They actually work superbly in the wet. I remember being up in North Wales around this time last year when it was hammering it down. I was in my car, and the bloke behind in a Lamborghini Aventador SVJ Roadster couldn't keep up.
Of course,
it was a perfect demonstration because that car had such wide aggressive tyres on it. It just couldn't cope with the standing water, and the little Alpine just sort of skipped through it. It was fantastic. The other advantage.
I'm probably going to say what you're about to say, but you know, obviously, the more rubber you put on the road, particularly at the front end, the worse your steering is going to be. You know, you only get, you know, really lovely steering feel. I mean, if you wanted to have a car with perfect steering feel, what you would do is give it a really stiff platform. You then put proper wishbone suspension on it. You keep the car very light, and then you would have as little tyre up front as you thought that you could get away with. You know, the only way to do better than that is to either have it, you know, hydraulic or unassisted steering, which is not practical these days. And that's exactly what, you know, Alpine have done. They've approached it from an entirely sort of purist direction, haven't they?
Absolutely.
And what you have got is a car with natural inherent grip, rather than grip that has been sort of accessorized into it after the fact because, you know, it doesn't have any of its own.
Yeah, grip in the chassis rather than the tyre. And you're right about the steering, and the A110 does steer really well, even though it's got actually quite a crude electrically assisted rack. It still steers really well. But the other advantage of having relatively narrow, not super sticky tyres is that the breakaway in the dry is very progressive. It's not a sudden loss of grip that causes a really frightening moment. And it also means that the car's limits on the road are much more accessible. So you can feel like you're dancing up to and around the limit of what the car can do without taking tremendous liberties. And that's fundamentally why the A110 is fun to drive on the road.
There you go. So tell me, 1 year on. So, I mean, I think the A110, it's one of those cars. I wonder if one of the reasons they haven't sold that many in the UK is there are an awful lot of people who read all the stuff that you and I and lots of others read about at the time and just thought, that sounds like a lovely idea, But you know what? In reality, I'll just go get a Cayman. Because I'm not just talking about the sort of snob value of the Porsche badge, but it's also because, you know, if you get a Cayman, you just know it's always going to work. It's not going to go wrong. It's never going to, you know, get on your nerves. It's just going to do that really dull everyday stuff that those cars do so well. So the question, Dan, is a year in, how has the reality matched the hype?
It has. That's the simple answer. It has matched the hype, and it's. I've loved having it. It's the car's so clever for me because it's brilliant fun to drive. You know, I jump out of supercars into my car and have maybe more fun, just because you can use its performance and grip on the road. But I have. It's a lightweight sports car. It's small. It's compact. But I've never ever winced at the prospect of a long drive in it or an early start in it or any of that stuff. I suspect, you know, Lotuses are great, but I suspect an Elise in the middle of winter, jump into it, airport dash, if it's chucking it down, you know, I think it might just get on your nerves a little bit. And other cars like it, you know, stiff ride, uncomfortable seats, very noisy on the motorway. That stuff would begin to, certainly me, it would wear me down. The A110 just has never done that. I just find it so easy to use daily, apart from the fact that there's just not much storage space.
I was going to ask that. There's no storage space in the cabin.
Not really.
And the boot is absolutely tiny, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but it's got two.
Yeah, but
and they're both tiny.
Yeah, but okay. I mean, obviously, you've probably not been able to because of lockdown and everything else. But you know, do you think you and your other half could have gone on holiday in it on a driving tour of Europe? As someone might want to, or it would just be completely impractical.
At a stretch, you know, you'd be shoving stuff behind the seats, probably passenger footwell. But if you're canny about how you pack, and I've got two of the sort of flight cases that fit perfectly underneath the front bonnet.
Ooh, Dan, do you have tailored luggage?
I do. I do. They are the branded Alpine.
Get you.
But so that makes the most of the space that you do have. And then, you know, you can get a couple of sizable soft bags in the back. So, yeah, you could do. You'd be packing light. We've done weekends away without any trouble. But more than that might be a bit of a stretch. But, you know, I just adore driving the thing. So you were asking about, wouldn't you just go and, you know, lots of people think it's a wonderful idea, but they just have a Cayman as well. But they just choose to have a Cayman instead. And that does resonate because this is the first brand new car I've ever bought, the first sort of valuable car I've ever owned. And I'm into driving and into the subject matter enough to not be sort of distracted by this stuff. But it occurred to me that I got the train up to Alpine Manchester to collect my car. And to get to the Alpine section of the dealership, I was brushing past, you know, a Renault Koleos and a Clio or something. If I'd been buying my first ever Cayman, I'd be walking into this swanky dealership. I'd be brushing past, you know, a brand new Panamera and 911s and fancy SUVs. And I'd be getting, you know, VIP treatment from the dealer staff and all this stuff. And I totally understand why some people will feel seduced by that.
But you're being devil's advocate here because none of that would have mattered a damn to you, would you? You'd only be thinking, I'm going to drive home in an A110.
Exactly. I didn't care, but I can...
You could have walked through a scrapyard and you wouldn't have cared less, would you?
I would not have cared. Not one bit. What I will say is, when I bought my car, there were only 6 dealerships in the UK. I think that's probably still the case. I'm doing this now because the car's been in for a service. It's first service after 12 months. And my closest dealership is Solihull in Birmingham.
Blimey. So they haven't got one in Bristol.
No, there's none in Bristol, nor any closer. And so, you know, that's a factor, isn't it? In terms of the overall ownership experience, I had to drive up to Solihull. It's a 2-hour drive, probably. And they were very good. Great service, by the way, from Solihull. And they were very kind. They let me take their demonstrator home. So that's a 4-hour round trip. And then a few days later, another 4-hour round trip to go and collect it again.
Yikes. And couldn't have done it. They couldn't have sort of just given you a room in an office where you could have just sat for 2 or 3 hours and then just driven your car Homer, because it can't even, you know, it's not complicated, is it? It's all McGann running gear. It shouldn't take that long to service.
Well, there were a few things I wanted them to have a look at, so they actually had the car for a few days.
Ooh. Has it gone wrong?
Well, there were rattles from the door cards.
Okay.
So, and they knew what the fix was. So it's just a couple of rubber grommets. There was the rear glass hatch has got a rubber seal glued onto it, and that glue can fail because of the heat of the engine. So they and that's a whole day to re-glue that.
Okay.
So there were a couple of bits and pieces like that they had to spend a bit of time, you know, putting right. But they did it, and the car doesn't rattle anymore. And it's apart from very, very minor things. Sometimes the infotainment system takes longer than I'd like for it to recognise my phone. As you know, the DAB reception can be pretty poor. So apart from those minor things, nothing sizable has gone wrong.
That's really good, because you may not remember this. I had a prototype, a very early sort of pre-production car here for a little bit, left hooker on French plates. What did that do? That's right. It would flatten its battery and lower its windows, which it once did overnight when it was raining. And it did it, and they went back and they thought they'd fixed it, but it hadn't, and then it happened again. But you've had nothing like that.
No, nothing like that.
No. Can I ask you a sort of slightly grubby question about money? Because do they depreciate much, or are there so few of them around? Are they so highly regarded that you're basically driving around in a free car?
It's not free car. No, I think the early cars, so from 2018, are fetching about 40k now. Probably a bit.
That's still pretty good, isn't it?
I think it is, and probably a bit more in a private sale. And that's the, you know, that's the first 18 months, say. That's the really steep part of the depreciation curve, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I suspect the first year, 18 months, they'll take a bit of a hit, and then the begin to level out and only lose value quite slowly. He says, you know, that's what I hope anyway. But then people aren't taking baths on them, that's for sure.
No. And we hear, don't we, that, you know, despite the fact that the car has not exactly been a runaway bestseller, although I believe in certain countries it's done better than it's done over here, which is strange because we love sports cars. But anyway, I hear that, you know, that Renault appear to be four square behind the brand, and despite, you know, our fears that they were going to can it and everything else, it's going to, you know, they're still going to proceed with it and, you know, and turn it into a, you know, not just a one car, but a proper, you know, a proper manufacturer.
Yeah, it does look that way. And we know the F1 team is switching from Renault to Alpine next year, which is really just they're changing the colour of some bodywork, aren't they, and some clothing. But it's an indication.
But they wouldn't be doing it if they were going to chuck it in the bin.
Yeah, and I think longer term, the Renault Group, Group Renault, probably see Alpine as its way of making electric cars more desirable. That's fundamentally it, isn't it?
Yeah. Good luck with that. Mind you, there is the BMW iX, which has just come out, and that's about as desirable an electric car as I've ever seen.
Go on. Let's just go down that alley.
No, do we have to?
Okay, let's not.
Do we have to?
Let's not.
I mean, okay, all I would say is, you know, I saw someone wrote that it was the replacement for the i8. How it's the replacement for the i8, I cannot see, because one is an absolutely stunning 2+2 hybrid, and this other is this abysmally ugly, massive SUV. I suppose because both of them have some form of electric power, they were able to make the connection. But two things. One is, I just don't understand why BMW is doing this. And secondly, I also really don't appreciate the attitude where if people call them out on it, they get these sort of slightly, we know better than you, you need to embrace the new, you stuck in the mud old, you know, insert expletive here. And I don't like that. I'm not that keen on that insinuation. And, you know, have you met anybody who really likes it? I mean, there are one or two people who, somebody wrote a blog on Autocar saying that they thought it was, you know, pointing out other cars in the past which have been very controversial when they came out. You know, cars like the Alfa SZ. And, you know, we all love the Alfa SZ, but I don't think any of us likes it today because of the way that it looks, in spite of the way that it looks, perhaps. Or maybe it looks have got to the stage now where if they're so familiar, you kind of aren't that bothered by them anymore. But I think it's going to be a while before I feel like that about the iX.
It's BMW's attitude towards being challenged on its design direction that's grating, isn't it? And the designers are absolutely defiant. Maybe they have to be, but they'll say stuff like, yeah, well, it's inevitable that bold design will be divisive. It'll always be 50-50. And it's not 50-50.
But it's not 50-50.
It's 95-5, isn't it?
And it's not bold design. It's just terrible design. I mean, because I'm not a designer and because I'm frankly far more interested in the way that cars drive than how they look, I look at these in very sort of simple binary terms. It's just ugly. It's just an ugly car. I don't particularly know why it's ugly, but, you know, I don't particularly know why my television works. I don't need to. I just know that it does. And it's just... Oh. I mean, it's just a shame, and it doesn't need to be like that. And, you know, things like the Audi e-tron and the electric Mercedes SUV, I mean, they're perfectly respectable looking cars. It doesn't need to be like that. So, I don't know. Anyway, let's not get sidetracked by that.
I'll be amazed if BMW...
I don't
BMW...
even know why I mentioned it now.
No, nor do I. I'll be amazed if BMW doesn't, you know, backtrack at some point and just take a slightly more conventional route, because...
I mean, okay, all I would say is, I mean, were you around for the Bangal era?
Yeah, I remember. And we all thought the 5 Series, the E60 looked terrible, didn't we, to begin with?
Yeah. Actually, I think the E60 looks pretty cool.
It does, yeah.
So maybe BMW does have a point. I suspect that's why BMW thinks it has a point, because it looks back at all those cars which were, you know, were very controversial and are now... A, completely accepted, and B, actually some people, myself included probably, think look quite cool. I think that if they've gone down that road, they've gone too far down that road. And I just hope that they pull back and have a think and just do this, you know, because BMW made some great looking cars, really, really great looking cars. But the iX ain't among them.
Right, let me just get back on topic for a couple of minutes.
Sorry.
I want to... So there's just one more thing that I want to talk about on my A110. So from quite early on, I had this nagging suspicion that my car felt a bit different to the very early...
You've said this before as well.
Yeah,
haven't you? Yes.
The very early premium edition cars. Sorry, premier edition cars. And in terms of the ride quality, mine felt a little busier, not quite as sort of freakishly lissom and fluid as the earlier cars that I drove. And one or two other people have been in the car and said the same. So I decided to get stuck into it a little bit. And one of the things I did was take it to Litchfield. Ian Litchfield he's got an A110, and he's been fiddling about with his, and he's put totally different suspension on his. His is an early Premier Edition car. And so it's a very early one. And so I got him to fit his springs onto my car, and it made no difference.
Made no difference?
Not as far as I could tell, no.
Gosh.
To be clear, my car still rides beautifully for that sort of machine. It doesn't quite have that ultra, you know, fluid feel that...
I know, yeah.
That I remember from the early cars. But the trade-off is that when you're really hammering along a tricky road, rather than sort of getting... a little bit out of phase with itself, as those early cars that I drove could do, it's just a bit more controlled. So I'm not even convinced it's worse. It's just quite different. And I got David Pook to sit in it, and he's the guy who's got an A110. He's doing all this Life 110 stuff. He is a sort of ride and handling engineer. And he just thinks that maybe my car has upper tolerance dampers. Because, you know, dampers cannot always be manufactured exactly the same. There'll be tolerance.
No.
And mine just might be...
Or maybe, you know, from those very early cars, and don't forget that, you know, all those early cars that you and I drove were... they were press cars, which I'm sure doesn't make any difference at all, but they were probably... Certainly the early cars I drove were all pre-production, and we all know that specifications change. I mean, manufacturers, they don't just wait until facelift time to make changes to the cars. Manufacturers are making changes to cars all the time. And I would say, probably with a car like an A110, which is a completely new car, you know, I'm sure they're still learning stuff about it, so I wouldn't be surprised if they hadn't had... You know, and also the other thing is that, you know... supplier contracts change. And maybe they had a contract with a manufacturer to do the launch cars, and then there was another OEM who supplied the dampers. I've no idea. I'm speculating wildly. I've genuinely no idea at all. But, you know, I suspect it is in the damping, and I suspect there has been, for one reason or another, a change in damper specification. And the only way you would ever find out is to find a car on an original dampers and retrofit them, which clearly isn't going to happen.
Well, I might talk to Litchfield and see if he'll put his dampers on my car. I suspect he will. So I'll give it a go. But, you know, you might well be right, but I know the engineers at Alpine reasonably well, well enough to just send them a DM on Twitter or something, or an email. And I trust them, and they all say there hasn't been a spec change. But who knows?
Oh, okay.
There could be a supplier change. It might well be that those early cars that we drove a couple of years ago, they just had absolutely spot-on dampers fitted to them. And, you know, Alpine were very careful to make sure that they did have those, and mine are just upper tolerance. Who knows?
Yeah, maybe.
Anyway, so that's my car, 7,200 miles in, just over 12 months, and it's fantastic. Everyone should
have it. You're using it, aren't you? Which is great.
Yeah.
I mean, given that all the other cars you've got to drive in the interim, I think the fact you've done over 7,000 miles in yours is good.
Yeah, I'm absolutely delighted with it, I have to say. Anyway, let's leave that there. Let's leave that episode there as well. We will be back to talk to you again next week, but I just have to remind you all, please, to review the podcast, give it a rating as well, but a generous rating. We don't want any 3 stars or anything like that. And remember as well to check out patreon.com/drivenation, because you can bung us a few quid a month, and that really, really helps. But Andrew, I suspect you're not going to tell us the outcome now. I think we ended last week's podcast by talking about this 2CV race that you're...
Oh, yeah, we've done it.
Go on. Can you tell us any more without giving anything away?
I don't think I can say anything other than, what can I say? It was great fun. We do definitely have a winner. One of us will be drinking an unfeasible amount of ale as a result, fairly shortly. I'll tell you what is good. What I can tell you about it is Neil Carey, who you know, and who shoots basically, you know, shoots almost everything for Chris Harris, which isn't Top Gear, and he's a fantastic bloke. He came down and he shot it, and, you know, we had cameras in the cars, we had a drone in the air, we had his big camera filming the whole thing, and as a result, what started off being basically just Christopher and me cocking about with our silly old cars. I mean, I've seen some of the sort of rushes of it, and it just looks really professional. It looks beautiful.
Yeah, we'll do it. So Neil's shooting it.
Yeah, well, exactly. And yeah, first of all, huge thanks to him, because, you know, I don't suppose anybody's bunging him anything to do it. But also, I think, you know, completely on top of, you know, Chris and I being stupid in our old cars, I think it's going to be quite a nice thing to look at, which is absolutely the last thing in the world that I expected. So if it hasn't come out by this time next week, and obviously, you know, Neil has to find time in his busy schedule to put it all together and everything else, so I will on DN and on other social and that sort of thing, I'll let everybody know where it can be found, when it's out, as soon as I know myself, which I don't at the moment. But it was good fun. I think it will be worth watching, and please, if you can, lob a bit of money to Mission Motorsport, which is the charity we're doing it for, which is the reason that we're doing it. That would be really, really appreciated. And the Just Giving page is in my Instagram. If you go into the Frankel Andrew Instagram thing, you'll find it in my bio. So there you go, plug over.
Yeah, and we'll leave a link in the description of this episode, so you can just tap through that way. Okay, all right, well, thank you everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Speak to you next week. Bye.
The Drive Nation podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.